But the good news is that gives us more time with the living legend himself, G Boss, who has wandered into the studio after a wonderful weekend. How are you, Bossy?
Felgate, I'm super fat, mate. I'm really good. What, Matty who? What?
Yeah, exactly.
He's a dodgy bloke. Yeah,
that's where he lives pretty much, constantly in a dodgy area. Hey, we've got some big breaking news, Bossy, off the top here, because a lot of people said, I think he's retiring too early, Glenn Boss, that it's not the right time to end his career. And you've had to think about it, and we can break the news. It's not all over just yet.
No, it's incredible. I got some information last night. I got an invitation, actually, and I think it's too good to be true, too good to pass up. The Saudi Cup meeting, which is a $20 million US meeting, they have a big race meeting on the Friday and the Saturday. I've been invited over there to ride in their invitation meeting. There's seven women and seven men from all around. You ride against Mike Smith and Frankie Dettori and alike, and that's on the 25th of February. So I've got to keep myself ticking over before we ride a bit of work and trials till then. So I'm really looking forward to it. It's massive prize money, and it's going to be a big event.
That is magnificent. So it is not over yet for G Boss. There is one last dance.
Well, I'm representing Australia. That's what it's about. So you don't get that opportunity now in our sport to do that very often. So yeah, this is what I'm going to do. I'm really looking forward to it.
So what's the format? Is it a number of races, a series on the day, or is it?
Yeah, there's a heap of races. I think there's about eight races on over the 2 days. And it's a ballot thing, and it's a point system, as they usually are, these things. But just the calibre of riders I'll be riding against is just going to be incredible. So there's seven women and seven men, so it's going to be a lot of fun.
And I know you're good mates with Frankie Dettori, so to pair up with Frankie on what will then be your last day of race riding would be an unbelievable experience.
Well, imagine riding against Mike Smith and Frankie, and the names, I'm not sure the whole list, but these are the guys that they've said I'll be riding against. So, that'd be unbelievable. What an experience that will be.
Did you get much international feedback and recognition over the weekend?
Oh, yeah, I did, actually. Even just this morning, I got an amazing voice message from Douglas White, you know, and, you know, it really brings tears to your eyes when you hear some of the stuff that these guys say. I've been blown away by that. And I've been blown away by Michael the Young.
Yeah.
It's incredible. I didn't realise, you know, I'm 52 and I did some pretty cool stuff a long time ago. I didn't realise I had that impact on young people. So that's been unbelievable, to be honest.
So logistically, what are you going to do now between now and February to keep yourself fit in form?
Well, I'm one of those guys, I'm never not fit.
No.
I'll always keep ticking over. I get in swimming, which I know that you're into. I get back into that, and just I'm always doing something. I'm naturally a fit guy. I will keep ticking over. Obviously, February I'll start riding some work, and again, I won't ride work for a little bit and get into some trials. So, because I want to go, if I'm representing Australia against these guys, you know, I want to make sure I'm on the job. So it's I'll treat it like a really big event.
Have you ridden over there before? Because you've ridden around the world.
No, well, Saudi's just a new place, isn't it? Mm. And now they brought this big race in, which is worth $20 million. I don't think I'll obviously get to ride in that because it's the horses that will come from Europe and America, and they'll have their riders. But I'll be there on that. Just to be there and be part of that experience would just be unbelievable. And see the facilities, you know.
You might need to give Bray and Ozzy a call and say, why don't you take one of these good horses over here for this $20 million race?
Yeah, pull one out of work, you know. Incentivise. What's he doing at the moment?
Exactly. Well, that is going to be a great way to officially end your international and Australian career as well. But the dust has settled on the weekend. Do you feel a bit of a weight off the shoulders, a relief? Because it was a pretty intense build-up after you announced it, the 48 hours.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I felt relief. I just feel vindicated because I feel like I've made the right decision. I could have carried on. There's no doubt I could have kept going. But I made a decision and I wanted to be very true to myself. Many years ago when I felt that I was thinking seriously about this, I would do it. Not just keep battling on trying to find that little bit of magic, you know. And I've been true to myself. I said to Sloane about this many years ago that, you know, this is something I've been thinking about and now it's really got to head. And I really realised over the 4 days of the carnival that, yeah, my mindset was starting to shift towards this. And like I said, you've really got to be true to yourself.
You have been so laser-like focused on everything. So when you say your mind started to shift, what was it exactly?
Just that. You have to be in this game at the level that I always want to be at and the level that I've always been at. You have to be laser-like. You have to be really into it, fully committed, fully invested. And I just found even just little things when I was sitting down doing my form, you know, just I could feel myself shifting, you know, and going to the races, just didn't quite feel it. And over that 4 days of Flemington, when I should have been up and about, and I didn't have any good rides, I will admit, it was all drying up. Yeah. I could see it in front of me, which is fine. Young kids were coming, the boys, young girls are coming through, and I was that young kid once pushing people out, you know, so you got to realize it's an evolution and your time has come. And I could just feel it mentally, and that's, it's a mental game. Mm. You have to be so mentally charged and laser-like, like you say, and it was time for me to go.
We're going to talk on the other side of 9 o'clock about where it began and obviously the highs that you've had, but some of the lows as well, the fall in Macau, and you were very open and honest with some of your mental demons. We'll touch on that, because I know that's an area you want to work on as well with mentoring moving forward for the young jockeys coming through, not just jockeys, as you've spoken about in the past, trainers as well, and the family. How important was it to have the family there on Saturday and to spend some time, because racing's 24/7, it's a brutal sport.
Yeah, very important, you know, and Tate and Carter at that age now, and Tate's 26 now and Carter's 21, you know, when I was doing that cool stuff, they were quite young and probably didn't get a sense of what it was all about, but you know, they've grown to know that, you know, the person that I was in the saddle, and I think it was just cool to have them there, you know, and just like Tate, you could, you know, he's just a younger, better version of me, and Carter's, you know, and I'm so proud of them, you know, they're just great people.
What do they do?
Well, Tate's into computers and he's a coder. He builds websites and he's getting quite good at that, and he'll carve a very good career for himself. And Carter's just a 21-year-old girl really just trying to find her feet, you know, and she's an intelligent young woman. She's a beautiful young woman, and she will find her way. She's just, you know, she really doesn't know what she wants to do in life yet, but whatever she does, it'll be good. But it was great. Sloane was there, and, you know, all these old things that you talk about, all these old cliches and that we talk about, Michael, are very true today, that you need a woman that's got your back all the time, and Sloane's that. You know, she's she's my biggest supporter. She's a fierce protector of me, and I'm very proud of her. I'm very proud of Tate and Carter, of what they've become, and I've been proud of what I've done throughout my career. You know, I've got not one black mark against my name throughout my 35 years of riding, and that goes back to the, you know, the people who taught me as a young person, my parents, my mum particularly, and when I first got with my first trainer, Terry Chinner, and then with Kay Tinsley, those things that they put into me, I carry true today.
We're going to talk about that after, where it all began, and also how much racing has changed. And without getting too deep into it now, because we've only got a couple of minutes to go, do you think it's a harder game now because of the relentlessness of it compared to when you started?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about that. And this is something that we have to address, you know. The participants are working longer hours, harder. The demands on them are harder. You can't live in the past to go to the future. You've got to keep evolving, and there's something that has to be done about that.
Well, Glenn Boss, I'm looking forward to the next hour. And the big breaking news, if you just missed it, is that it's not all over just yet. After an invitation overnight, Glenn Boss will be representing Australia riding on Saudi Cup night on February 25th. Wowee. That is going to be something to count down to as well. We will take a quick break into the news, and then on the other side of this, more of Glenn Boss, the master rider and showman. All that still to come on Racing Pulse. Welcome back to Racing Pulse, and this is going to be an enjoyable hour because Glenn Boss is in the studio. He's looking relaxed, tanned, fit, and ready to go, even though the breaking news is that he has one more day of riding left, representing Australia on Saudi Cup Day on February 25, after being invited to take on the likes of Mike Smith and Frankie Dettori over there. That's going to be one hell of a party, Bossy, when it does end over there.
Yeah, Sloane's already started looking at Saudi, what the scenarios are over there, but, can you imagine? Just being in the room, you know, with those guys. And I'm not sure of the women who are going to be competing, but obviously they're going to be the best of the best. So it's going to be one hell of a show.
In the jockey ranks, is that the biggest change you've seen in your time? The emergence and now in some quarters the domination of female riders here in Australia?
Yeah, and I love it. Throughout my whole life, I've always recognised women with horses. Mm. It's an amazing fit. They just have this... They have... Like, animals with men are a little... You know, they understand that we're quite aggressive. You know, we're like to be the dominant one. And horses can sense that. But with women, they've got no agenda. They just want to be involved. They just want to... You know, somehow they fit, you know. And you just see the way these young women have that affinity, they have that balance, and they just seem to extract so much from a horse doing so little. And that's what I've been about my whole career. I'm trying to be as kind to them and do as little of them. I've always thought the little you do, the more you get. And I can just see that coming now, and gee, there's some talent. And the way they're coming online so early now, because they're so privy to everything, you know what I mean? They can read a lot more. They can see a lot more replays than what we do as kids. So they're actually coming online really quick at a young age, and they're doing stuff I couldn't even imagine I could do.
You did say that when we spoke to you on Saturday morning, you said, you know, I don't consider myself a great jockey, but I'm a great horseman. And is that innate thing that you're talking about, the connection with the animal?
Yeah, what I was as a young guy, we had to learn, like, we had to learn about the anatomy of an animal. We had to know how they thought processes. We had to learn a lot. And I was taught that as a young guy. So I really knew a lot about a horse before I was 10. You know, we would just do crazy things on horses. No saddles. I never got a saddle until I was about 8.
Yeah.
You know, I rode bareback, you know, and halter and lead. But it was just, we were taught to shoe. We were taught to brake, you know. And I believe that the young, I'm not asking kids to do that now, but they should be really taught about how these animals actually work before they actually ride them. Mm. You know, get a real understanding. You don't just get in a car and, you know what I mean? You actually know how to push the brake. You know how to accelerate. You actually got to learn how a car works before you drive it. And unfortunately, that's lost. The art of that is lost. So I think that's something we should bring back.
So where did it all start for you? Where did your first introduction to the thoroughbred or the horse come from?
Well, when we were mixed farmers in Caboolture, you know, and we had horses on the property. And from the time that I was strong enough to ride a horse, I was introduced to him. And that's how we started at 4 years old. And I was just, I can remember vividly, Michael, I was attracted to the animal straight away. And once I become part of riding them and being around them, I was just fascinated by the animal. I used to just love being around them. I love being on them. I just could just watch horses being in a paddock and watch them for hours because I was just fascinated by the animal.
Did you have any fear factor, or do you believe that some people have got the gift and others, doesn't matter how hard you try, you'll never be as good as those who have the natural gift?
Oh, there's doubt. There's no doubt. But you can learn. You know, there's many ways to get from A to B. Some people get there quicker. Some people don't have to do much effort and they get there. Some people have to work their butt off and but find their way to get from A to B. But you can all get there. Mm. I think it's just a matter of how applying yourself. And fear, I was never scared. I was just, even now, I've got no fear of an animal. I actually feel more comfortable on the horse's back than I do walking on the ground.
Really?
Yeah, I love being on their back. Now, I just love being around them. And I think they know that you've got confidence, you know. Like I said, there's men and women out there who think that it could be too hard. It's not that hard. And there's different ways to get there. You just got to find the way that suits you.
When did the light bulb go off then? You were riding horses from a young age. You loved it. When did you go, you know what, I think I could be a jockey?
Well, it was an incredible experience. Holidays from school, and obviously I was in about grade 10. I went out to my grandparents' farm in Gympie, and my grandfather was a bit of a hobby trainer. He just had a couple of horses mucking around, and so my grandmother she loved to go to the races, and she said, would you like to go to the races in Gympie one day? And I said, yeah, for sure. I'd got no idea what a race meeting was, but I was keen to go. And we went to the races, and we parked. Where we parked was down near the top of the straight at the there was a race being run, and so I ran across to the outside fence, and I'm not sure if anyone's, well, if you've experienced ground level and about 10 horses coming around you with, when you're only metres away, the ground moves, the speed of it, and the colour of it, just the speed of it, and grabbed me. And I was hooked. That I couldn't believe what I'd just seen. And Monday, I was back at Caboolture High School, and I quit school. And the following weekend, I was actually back in Gympie being introduced to Terry Chinner, who was going to be my master and my trainer. And that was how quickly the turnaround was. That was it, because I was just hooked, and I just wanted to thought, how quickly can I do this?
What would the sliding door moment have been if you didn't go to the races that day? What would G Boss have become?
Yeah, I got no idea. I was very keen going through school that I was going to try and be a, like veterinary science. That was something I was very interested in, and Gatton College was the place to go. So I was going to maybe work towards something like that, working with animals, and horses were probably a big part of that. Yeah. You know, so I don't know if I was smart enough to do that. I really don't know. But if that was something that I chose, I would have really got invested in that and probably become that. But racing just chose me, and that was what I thought was going to be the cool thing.
Outback Queensland would have been pretty rough and ready back in the day. What was it like as a young apprentice?
As fun as hell.
Was it?
Oh, my God. We went to some places, and they didn't have even fences on the outside, you know. But it was just so much fun, you know. I can never not having fun going to the races. And if someone couldn't ride and the trainer come in, who wants to ride this horse? I'd want to knock him down to get on that horse just because I didn't have a ride in that race. I mean, I remember the days in Gympie, and my first year I won the senior title and the apprentice title, and I only rode for 10 months of that year. And of that 10 months, I spent probably two months on the sidelines through being suspended, you know, because I was just hell bent on winning everything. But yeah, I just smashed him that year. And then Graham Oland could see that he was the head steward up there at the time, and he was obviously Brisbane steward, but used to come up to Gympie. He could see that I had a bit of talent, and he said, you're not going to be here for too long. And he got me transferred down to Kay Tinsley at the Gold Coast. And that was just part of it, start of it.
Is it true you rode your very first winner on a quarter horse?
Yeah. Terry Chin and my boss trained quarter horses. So that was my first experience. First winner. It was a 300-metre sprint race, you know. But Terry was Terry and his wife were unique people. They were absolute horse people. The way they broke, they taught me so much. It was just another evolution in my career to, and it was all about the animal, the care for them, the way we did things, the way they actually got into horses' minds really intrigued me. The way they did things with horses, the way they broke them, it was an incredible experience and something that I can, that took me through my whole career.
So you went to Kay, and then how much of that was that a change in your, I suppose, learning curve to become the jockey that you are today? Who were your mentors at those times?
Well, Kay was my mentor, and he wasn't. He was more about the jockey side of it. Where when with Terry, it was about being the horseman. And when I got down to Kay, because he was a rider himself, so he was teaching me about the finer points of being a jockey. So that's another part that came in. And this is all just sort of the steps that I was taking. And Kay was really staunch on some of the things he taught me, you know, about don't be seen with these people. Don't go to that pub. If you want to be the great jockey, you've got it. There's things that you must do. Don't get in trouble. Don't break the law. But, you know, be respectful of the people who are upholding the laws. He was big on that, you know, and just be a good person. And he just taught me a lot of finer points about riding, which was, you know, which just resonated really strongly with me, and hard work, you know. And I was always about hard work. You know, coming from a farm background, hard work was just something I knew anyway. But he just took it up another notch, and it was very good.
And then how long was it until you decided to make the move to the big smoke and head to Sydney?
Yeah, that was a different situation. I was battling away in Brisbane. I was going okay. I was running second to Chrissy Munce every time in the apprentices title, and I always wanted to be Chrissy Munts. You know, he was had a lot of support in Brisbane, and I always strived to be Chris Munts when as he was my idol. You know, as a kid, being a same year apprentice, and Chris had the flash cars,
did
and
he?
You know, he had all the flash stuff, and always everyone wanted to be him. But and then, you know, I went down a couple of trips with Noel Doyle to Sydney. He brought Kinchite down and a couple of good horses. And I ended up riding a few winners for Maxie Lees, the late Maxie Lees. And I won a stakes race for him. And he said to me, if you ever come back to any boy, you know you'll get my support. And I rode a few winners for Clary Connors, who was flying at the time. And he was another one and said, if you ever come back down here, I'll give you support. And it came a time where I thought, you know what? I was a senior rider. I was second year into my senior. I thought it was time I chanced my arm. And I drove down to Sydney and the rest is history.
So what year is that?
That would have been 94.
And the Sydney Jockey Room was star-studded.
My God. Okay, you got D Deep, Deerham Beeman, you've got Jimmy Cassidy, Mark de Montfort, Shane Dye,
Ronnie Quinton.
Oh, Ronnie Quinton was still riding. The list goes on and on.
Mick Dipman?
Mick Dipman was still massive. So I walked into this cauldron and all the jockeys who I'd read about and idolised, Malcolm Johnson.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, I'm amongst these people.
What was it like in the jockey's room with them?
Oh, incredible. I was like a deer in the headlights and a big sponge. All I wanted to do was learn and watch. My biggest idol then, growing up, was Malcolm Johnson, you know, and then all of a sudden, I'm sitting with this bloke and talking to him. It just blew me away. And reading about TJ Smith and all that stuff, and all of a sudden I've got TJ Smith putting me under his wing and saying, oh, you know, you ride for me and that. And so I was like second under Shane Dye not long after, and I won a slipper the year after. You know, it was a whirlwind time for me and incredible.
Well, the slipper was your second group one.
Mm.
Let's relive your first. This was Telesto for Graham Begg.
Burst is the first to go after him, followed by Kingston Bay, and now Telesto, hooked to the outside, is starting to wind up, clearly chosen, about to be tackled by Burst, and look at Telesto coming down the outside at 100 miles an hour, he finally wins another one, Telesto beat clearly chosen.
Burst, what a horse to ride your very first group one on, because he was an enigma.
He was an enigma, and you had to actually get into his head and let him be what he wanted to be. And I'd watched his tapes and I spoke to Shane, who was his regular. He couldn't ride him that day. And he was one of them colts that year, just had to let him be the boss and trust that when he decided to do what he wanted to do, that he was going to deliver it. And I just wrote him exactly how he spoke. I just let him do what he wanted to do and tacked on at the 600 meter mark. And I knew that he'd break 34, you know, that's, if you allowed him to do that, that's what he would do. And he just, I gave him a good ride and he burst through and won my first group one. And that was the first moment that there was a sense of belonging, that I'm in the right place.
Did you feel, I suppose, it came relatively quickly for you, but did you feel like I've got to get this monkey off the shoulder to actually have that sense of belonging before then?
Yeah, obviously there is an expectation that you want to win a group one race because you want to be a group one rider. And you actually don't know how you're going to feel, and you actually don't even know how to execute that point. Execute that until you actually get in that moment, and you do execute in a group one, and all of a sudden you think there's a big sense of that you now belong here because you've done it.
And then the jockey tape scandal breaks,
and
Flying Spur occurs. Take us through that period.
Well, a crazy week. First of all, I was on a very good horse for early in the week. Sterling Smith trained it, and it was a horse that had won, 2 year old, had one start for one win, and was very impressive. And we thought he could run well in the slipper. He went amiss on the Tuesday, so I was without a ride. And then all of a sudden, this jockey tape things come out, and Jimmy Cassidy was riding Fly Spur, you know, was subsequently taken down because he didn't appear for a meeting, and I was thrust upon Flying Spur, like the eve of the car, of the slipper. And it's funny, he was 20 to 1 shot, but it was a bit of a bit of movement about him, as he was a very good colt, and there was a bit of noise about this was a colt that could win the slipper, even though it was a great slipper, octagonal, and you know I like winning the race. And that was the feeling I got when I was legged up on him from Lee. He said, "There's two things this colt will do. He'll either win or he'll run last." And he said, "You'll know by the time you get to the barriers what colt you've got." And I didn't quite know what he was saying to me until I got to the barriers, and I knew exactly what he said because I knew I could win the slipper before I got in the barriers. That's the feeling I got from that colt. And what an I actually said to one of the boys behind the road, "This horse will win the slipper." And he just said, "That's a stupid thing to say." That's the confidence that colt gave me going to the barriers. I've never felt a horse like that.
Winning one of the majors, how much does that change for a jockey, your career?
That's everything. It changes everything. You're thrust into the limelight. And what it does, it tells everyone, all them great trainers, that you're capable of doing that job. I mean, I was thrust into that moment unexpectedly. But giving that opportunity is just an opportunity if you don't do anything, if you don't make good with it. And I made good with that opportunity. And it really made people sit up and take notice that G-Boss is probably a serious rider. And it wasn't, you know, but now you've got to back it up, you know.
Was that a weird time for you to be a jockey in Sydney with that jockey tape scandal?
Yeah, it was kind of weird, but winning that race overshadowed everything for me. Like, now, I wasn't a part of that, so it didn't really have anything to do with me. Obviously, watching the guys that were involved in it, but then the G-Boss mindset starts ticking over. I'm thinking, well, there's some opportunities, you know, here, and I've just won a slipper, and the business side of that, now I've got to capitalise on what I'm doing now, and that's when the real hard work started.
Putting Maccabi aside, do you have favourite group ones when you have looked back on the 90 that you've had here? Is there a couple that stand out?
Yeah, the Doncaster was a race that was intrigued me as a young guy. And before I wanted to win a Melbourne Cup, I wanted to win a Cox Plate. Because I was given a tape when I was 15 years old. It was called The King and the Man, Manicato and Kingston Town. And watching Manicato win those William Reeds at Moonee Valley and watching Kingston Town weave his magic around the valley, it was really embedded in my psyche. This is a magic place, because I didn't really know much about Flemington at this point. I'm talking about a 15-year-old kid. So all I wanted to do was get to Moonee Valley. And because the stories about this race were huge, you know, and it seemed to have a mystique about it. And that's the race that I really wanted to win as a young kid.
Well, let's play So You Think, because I want to talk to you about that ride and Bart.
So You Think is about a half in front of Manhattan Rain, and the three-year-olds lead by two or three. Who've you got to running on with Heart of Dreams? So You Think led by two lengths. He shook off Manhattan Rain. Who've you got to an El Segundo charging home, and it's all over. So You Think is going to go all the way. He's racing clear, and So You Think has bolted in the Cox Plate. Manhattan Rain ran second.
That was where we got to see the famous Bossy celebration. When did you make the call, you know what, we're going to the front?
Well, that was probably just an instinctive move. I rode him in a jump out on the Tuesday, I think, or 10 days before. So it would have been the Thursday, or the jump out's the Friday, sorry. And I realised he was a very headstrong colt. And what Bart wanted me to do, he wouldn't jump out the barriers, and he was putting blinkers on him for the first time, so that was the reason for the jump out. And he said, I want you to do is make him jump out and go a furlong and then pull him up, because he doesn't need any galloping. Anyway, he jumped well. I went a furlong, and all of a sudden, he's just building underneath me. And when I locked him down, I just knew that he didn't want to be locked down. He was a kind of want to be a free-running type of horse, you know. And so that was in my thinking, if he wants to do what he wants to do, I'm just going to let him do what he wants to do. Because if you get into an arm wrestle with this big colt, there's only going to be one winner, and it won't be me. And actually, at the end of the day, there won't be a winner, because I'll bring him undone. So when he jumped out and I felt him wanted to go, that was just my feeling. I'll just let you do what you want to do. And fortunate for me, when he did, he got to the front, he just started to relax, and I was sort of talking to him throughout the run and asking him to breathe, you know, like I just wanted to make sure he relaxed. And midway through the race, it was all over.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was all over.
Is he one of the best you've ridden, even though that was the early part of his really rise?
Yeah, I've only ridden two champions in my life, and I don't use that word loosely, and you know what the other one was.
Yeah.
And he was the champion. He was the sexiest horse I've ever laid eyes on. Oh, my God. He was Brad Pitt on in four legs. Like, he just oozed class, but he had charisma too, you know? And he went on to prove himself as one of the world's best horses. So he was one of my biggest thrills and one of my biggest regrets in my life.
The regret being?
Not being able to continue on that association.
Yeah.
And through no fault of mine.
Was that after the next run in the Emirates?
Yeah, after the Emirates. And, you know, and there was probably a moment, I probably did go too soon on him, but that was just the thing. He was second up. He didn't need the blinkers on second time because it did the job the first time, but he was way too over the top when he went to the Emirates, and I knew that. People don't understand what I went through to just even get him to the barriers that day and how he reacted to me in the race. He was just, you know, he was a raging lunatic that day, and just being freshened up for that mile race, you know, he was a big, fresh colt anyway. I probably pushed the button too soon on him, but there were so many other factors that got him beat that day, and he shouldn't have got beat. And just being taken off in that, that really hurt me hard that way when they told me I wasn't to continue with him, and I wasn't given a right or reply either. You know what I mean? I was just told I was taken off, and that's a scar that I still have today.
Was that from directly Bart or the ownership?
There was a few people involved, and I won't mention their name. There was one particular guy, and I won't mention his name. He was pretty, pretty hardcore.
Need to take a break, but I'll talk more about rejection and having to deal with that as a jockey as well, because it's a cutthroat world, and a few of the other highlights, and then I want to get into some of the darker times, the injuries, the falls. I thought it was salient that when you said on Saturday night that one of the happiest things I've got is I'm fit and I'm healthy, because a lot of jockeys don't get to leave the sport that way as well. So plenty more to discuss with Glenn Boss and what the next chapter holds as well. The legend live in the studio here on a special edition of Racing Pulse.
The news and stories from racing's heartland. This is RSN's Racing Pulse.
And here comes Grand Army. Grand Army with a brilliant run right down the outside. He is swamping the opposition. Grand Army well to the lead. Private Steer is flying home. Grand Army, Private Steer. Private Steer has got up to win it.
It was one of the great rides and wins, Private Steer, one of seven Doncasters. Do you remember that ride vividly?
Oh, my God, I remember that week. I think I rode six Group 1 winners that week.
Really?
Yeah, it was an incredible week. You know, when they had the 3 days of that 1 week? Yeah, I managed to ride. It was six Group 1s in a week. Incredible. But, yeah, she was one of the best I've ridden, Private Steer. She was unbelievable electric. I watched her win a maiden by 10 lengths one day, and I moved hell on earth to try and get on her. And I did get on her in a Stradbroke. She had 48 kilos. And she duly saluted and bolted in, and then she went on to be one of our better milers in Australia.
You're remembered for a couple of unbelievable rides, and one of them was that image of you shaking your head when you crossed the line on God's Own and the Guineas. Can you relive that? What was going through your mind during that Guineas?
Yeah, there was a lot. most of it was bad, you know. Like he got dealt to a couple of serious times in that race, and the first one was at the 1400-metre mark. He got proper dealt to and just nearly fell. He got run off the track, and then we had to regain our composure, and we actually worked ourselves into a winning position, I thought. And I thought, well, I've done really well here. I've got myself in a winning position without doing too much. And then I went for a run, and Noel Kello come out and went straight underneath my neck and just absolutely poleaxed me. And I remember going past Noel, and I swore at him, and I told him he just cost me the Guineas, you know, so uncertain terms. And then Paratroopers, I could see, was starting to stop on make, you know, he made his run, but he was starting to stop. And I could feel my horse just starting to rev up again, you know, after everything had happened to him. I could feel him starting to surge again. And I got to the 100-metre mark, and I thought, this is horse is going to win. I could feel the ground I was making up. And when I crossed the line, I just had to shake my head in disbelief, because it shouldn't have happened, and it did. It was one of those great moments.
Another one for Bart. What was it like riding for the Cups King?
It was incredible, because used to write a lot of work for Bart, and I got a real sense of what Bart was all about. Just speaking to him and listening to him and watching him, he was an incredible observer of the animal. And people used to say, you know, you could see these horses, like, say, you think, well, just come online, you know, like, just say he's won the Cox Plate as a maidener. But people wouldn't see the 18 months of work that horse, that guy put into that horse. You know, he used to just let the horse come to him. He'd get him to a point where he knew that he could push the button, and he wouldn't push the button until he let them actually tell him that they were ready to be pushed. So he would mould that horse until that point, and then he'd give it to them. But they were ready to cop it. So that horse would be an overnight success, but it was 18 months or 2 years in the making, you know what I mean? And incredible. Just his attention to detail. And like I said, he would do things. Like, you'd be riding horse work a month before, and all of a sudden that horse would be doing completely different work. And then it would just come online for some, you know, it was incredible to watch. And he did that all the time.
When you're so close and working with these trainers, did it ever cross your mind one day you might like to have a crack at that, or is it just too hard work?
To be very honest, I reckon I'd be a very good trainer. But I don't know if I could handle the I love the animal. I'm not sure if I love the business side of it, you know, the dealing with the other side of it. I don't think I could do that, to be very honest. If you just want to put me with the animal and do that, yeah, no problem. I don't have to speak to too many people, that'd be a lot of fun, you know, because I really understand the animal. I just have a way with them. But I mean, you never say no to anything, honestly, through life, and I've realised that. There might be an opportunity. You never know.
Well, you just never know. If there was an opportunity where a business, you know, there's organisations that are popping up now that say, you know what, we'll look after the business side.
Absolutely. That's the way our sport has evolved. And this is what I was trying to allude to before. I think there should be an academy for trainers. Because, you know, if two like-minded people come together and one's, you know, the yin and the yang, one's the horseman, one's the business person, and they can run a business like that. Because I think that's where our sport is evolving, because it's too hard for one person to handle. It's too big a business. I mean, we watch Chris Waller, but he's got an amazing team around him. It's just not Chris Waller. He's the front man, no doubt, but he's got an incredible... And he talks about that all the time. You've got to be able to have the yin and the yang, so when you need a break, you can go away and you know that your business is going to keep running, and vice versa. When that person needs to go away and have a break, you need to be able to keep that business running. I think that's where this...
We've seen a lot of partnerships now. We've seen the bigger stables almost becoming like corporations. Do you think we need to have more training on the other side for those who want to get in it? And maybe do we have too many trainers?
I think I firmly believe we have way too many trainers in this game. And I believe most of them are probably not making a dollar. They're struggling. If you're struggling in a business for 4 or 5 years, you got to look at yourself and go, well, you know what? This is probably not what I should be doing. Maybe I need to go into a partnership with someone. Maybe I've got something to offer someone else that's not going well. You know, you got to look outside the box and say, you know, if you're running a business and it's not making money, you get out, don't you? Even if you've got the passion for it. But I think it needs to start. We need to educate younger people and have an academy where if you give them the tools, and if it's not for them, it's not for them. But it might be for them, and they might get together. And like I say, it's a corporation these days. You're running a big business.
Is it similar for jockeys? Is it now too tough for a lot of jockeys out there, because there's superstars like yourself, Glenn, but there's not too many in that category? Then you've got a group that can make a nice living, and then you've got others who are just eating the paint off the wall.
Well, I think they should be treated like real athletes that they are. I think, okay, when you're an apprentice and you haven't got your license yet, yeah, you work every day and you learn the trade and do all that. I think once you get your license, you shouldn't have to ride work every day. You should be treated like a jockey. And you're not a jockey yet, obviously. You still got to learn. But I think you should, because these kids have got to start at 3:30 in the morning. You try to sell this to a kid. Okay, you're going to get up. You're going to work at 3 o'clock every morning. You're going to bust your ass. You're going to have to not eat properly to maintain your weight. You're going to get in a car and you're going to drive 2 or 3 hours to a race meeting. You're going to ride all day. Then you're going to come home and you drive 3 hours to get home, and then you're not going to have much sleep. and then you're going to repeat that again. You try and sell that to someone.
Mm.
It's not a good sell. And obviously you're going to see all the highlights and you're going to see the good stuff, but there's only a few people that get to that point. But I think you've got to give these kids, and you've got to nurture them and give them every opportunity to be the James McDonald or the D. Oliver. And to do that, you've got to help them and nurture them in a respectable way and treat them like the athletes that they're going to become.
You've got so much to offer. You've got so much experience. Is that something, as well as what you're going to be doing with Ladbrokes, that you want to get into, the mentoring, but also maybe talking to Racing Victoria, either working for Racing Victoria or advising from the coalface out what things could need to change to make the sport better?
Yeah, I want to learn as much as I possibly can about the other side of this racing industry, the business side of it. I want to, you know, even though I just said I don't want to be in that, but I want to learn. But I want to be the person on the ground. I don't want to be in an office. I will not be restrained to an office. I can't work in an office, so it's not me. I want to be the guy that's on the ground, listening and talking to the participants, what they need, what can we change. And I want to try and implement those changes for the better good. I know I can sit there and everyone's going to have an opinion, right? But they've got to be able to back up their opinion. If they've got to come to me with a problem, they've got to come to me with a bit of a solution and a proper solution. You know, not just come with some argument. Come to me with a solution and we'll sit down and talk about that. I want to be that person, you know what I mean, in our industry. And I want to help as many people I want to go to the people who don't have these protesters or the people who want to see this thing shut down, and I want to educate them. I want to sit down and talk about them, what their fears are, what they think about our sport, and I want to show them our sport in a different way, in the way it actually is, the true part of it, the way we care about these animals, the way we care about the participants in the industry. And I want to... Don't come with a naive approach and just stand there with a banner and say, this industry kills horses. That could be nothing further from the truth, because they're ignorant, uneducated people about our industry. And I don't want to change their mind. I want to just show them. And if they've still got that same approach, you can't be changed. But I guarantee they'll have a different mindset about our industry after I finish talking with them.
The reduction in whip use over the last few years. Are you in favour of that?
Absolutely. I think it's imperative that we keep changing. I think it's imperative that we keep this situation. It's a big issue. Welfare, the whip, and I've been working on something behind the scenes for the last couple of months, and I think if I can get this to work and get this concept I've been thinking about, it could be a game changer for our industry.
Do we need to change the mindset of a lot of people within the industry? Because there are a lot of people that just won't change and don't believe that outside the racing bubble we should take any notice of what they think.
Well, these guys have got to step away from the bubble and actually get out there and see what people actually think about our sport and the way it's conducted, and you'll have a different mindset. When you're in the bubble and you're so protective about your industry, and you yourself can become very ignorant about it. You've actually got to get out there amongst the people and the young people, because these are the people that we need, and ask them about, you know, or just get their thoughts. And you'll have a different idea about the sport yourself.
Glenn Boss, champion jockey, live in the studio. We'll take a quick break. On the other side of this, we've got to mention the Diva. We'll also talk about that fall in Macau and more of what the future holds for Glenn Boss, the champion jockey.
Don't care if I sound crazy, but you never let me down. Digital radio, the app, and streaming. RSN's Racing Pulse.
Kyvie Diva's racing up. Envoy's trying to go with her. They've got to Portland Singer and Lachlan River. Here comes Like a Falcon and Excellent. But Kyvie Diva clear with 100 metres to go. Excellent runs to second. Otterzoon runs on. But a champion becomes a legend. Kyvie Diva has won it from either Otterzoon. Excellent.
Oh, it still gives you goosebumps when you hear that line from Greg Miles, Kyvie Diva. So much has been spoken about it, Bossy. But when you look back on your career, are you almost as proud of not what you achieved, but the way you handled it? Three of the best cup rides we've probably ever seen.
Yeah, like growing up, watching the Kingston Town and then watching Greg Childs with that great Sunline, you only hope that you get an athlete, get involved with an athlete like that. And once I got that opportunity, I knew that I was on something special, and I made a unconscious decision and a conscious decision that I was going to make sure that I did this really right, because they're a shining light and they don't last long. That sometimes it's one season, sometimes, but I had it for four seasons. Yeah. Incredible, right? At a great level. So I really made a decision that I was going to make sure I really showcased her and did it properly. Like, there was nothing going to be left on the table when she finished and I finished with her, you know. So I was very conscious of making sure that the public got everything, the press got everything that I could possibly deliver.
Peter Moody and Chris Waller have both said the relief when Black Caviar and Winx retired because of the pressure. Did you feel that at all with Maccabi Diva?
No, none whatsoever. I just felt real joy. Mm. You know, David Hall had done an amazing job and he left. And then I just watched what Lee Friedman did with her. Like, the master Lee Friedman is. Like, he just moulded her. And what he did, he let me in. He asked me a lot of questions about her. I knew more about her than he did. And he said, you know, he allowed me to be part of that journey. And that felt so great. You know, just have Lee Friedman, Hall of Fame trainer, asking me to be part of this, you know. Not trainer, but just be part of the experience as far as helping her, helping him bring her to the best she was. And just to watch this athlete evolve in that four seasons to what she became, I was so proud. That was I was so proud of what we both achieved together. Not just me, you know, obviously Lee, Tony and Chrissy, you know, and everyone was all along for the ride, you know. So, yeah, I didn't have a relief moment. I just had just awe, you know. Yeah. That last moment I had on her when I took my hands off the rein when she stood in front of the crowd, that was my greatest moment on an animal, on a horse in my life.
And she knew it.
It almost felt like, this is not like a movie scene or anything, it's not like, you know, but it felt like she had a sense of occasion, and she looked from one end of the straight to the other. I'm getting goosebumps talking about this now. And I had a sense that she knew that she was the one that was on show. Incredible.
Well, that was without doubt the unbelievable highlight. But take us back to Macau. Was it 2002 where you had that shocking fall, and how close that came to ending everything?
Yeah, it was just a normal fall, Michael, and but just the way I landed was not normal. So I was very fortunate. I was conscious when I fell, and I was able to tell the guys that I'd broken my neck, because I knew straight away that the heat was in the back of my head and the pain, and I knew it straight away. And that was just maybe the angels were looking after me, because that was a moment that probably saved my life, because if they shifted me and moved me, because I broke my C2 in three places and I broke through the body, and it was a stable fracture because I hadn't moved, but it could have quickly turned into an unstable fracture if I'd been moved like 10 degrees, they were saying, 10 degrees left or right, it would have severed my spinal cord, and basically that's, you die, you know, because it controls everything. So, yeah, I mean, just a few things. I mean, it was a bad fall, but the stuff that happened after it were all good, you know what I mean? Being conscious and being introduced to Julian Chang in Hong Kong, who was probably regarded as one of the greatest neurosurgeons in the world, and him operating on me, and then had some very aggressive neurosurgeons when I got back home to Sydney, and all working towards the same goal. Because I was told initially that, you know, I mightn't ride again. Mm. It'd be too dangerous, and just getting you back walking and having a normal life would be cool, right? But that was not going to be on my agenda. That was not going to happen. So when I got back to Sydney, like I said, I had some great surgeons there that were on the same page. And, yeah, I couldn't wait to get back on the paddock.
How tough is that part of being a jockey? I mean, a number have lost their lives in your career.
Yep.
And you see what recently has occurred to Ty Anglin, who was a good friend of yours in the jockey ranks. Is that thought about much? Do you try and stick that at the back of your mind?
When it happens, you think about it, but you don't think about it happening to yourself. You know what I mean? Like, more recently, when watching Corey, you know, who was a good friend of mine, you know, and Ty, like, geez, these are, and not just them, but, you know, others. But when you watch them, it really hits home. I knew when Corey fell at Eagle Farm that day, I knew straight away, and the whole room knew this was not good. And just to feel that room that day was black. It was like a black cloud was over the room. And, so you think about those things, but you can't you can't, you know, I mean, you just push it aside and you carry on, because you can't have those thoughts out there when you're riding. There's absolutely no way. And I'll never have had a thought like that when I'm out there riding. Because if you do, you're slowing your process down of thinking, and you become a danger to others.
People love you, Bossy, because you wear your heart on your sleeve. You're emotional from the high of highs, but you've also had the low of lows. And I think you opened up a lot of people's eyes earlier in the year when you did an unbelievable piece for Ladbrokes. And that's probably where the relationship almost started. And that's where it's now heading post-racing. But for those who missed it and need reminding, this is a snippet of what Bossy had to say about some of his dark times and suicide.
I've been close, yeah. I was close at one point, and, in one time of my life, I was super close, so... and dead set serious too, you know, but... You can't do it to yourself. It's just... It's disrespectful. I promise you, you can come back. People can be in such a bad place and get to a point where they think they don't want to be here anymore. There is definitely a way back, 100%.
It's pretty gutsy to put that out there so publicly.
Yeah, well, it was a... I hope I don't get emotional here, but the 23rd of July, when I come back from Singapore, I was in a hell of a dark place. I was scared about coming back to Sydney. I didn't know how I'd be accepted. I'd been doing some stupid things in Singapore, self-medicated, alcohol, away from the family, completely off the tracks. Destroying my family life, destroying my wife, destroying my kids, no respect. And I was going down such a black road, Michael. I turned back and I couldn't see the light, and I thought, well, I'll just keep going this way because I can't go back. And I attempted suicide.
You actually attempted?
Yeah, I attempted suicide. And it was only through the sheer determination of my son and, trying to find me and seeing, they knew something was wrong, and... the police found me in a hotel completely unresponsive. And, all I remember is waking up in hospital with cords all over me, and they brought me back, you know. And Liam Pryor, to his credit, never left my side for a couple of days. And, it was just unbelievable. And I did such a disrespectful thing. Not only to myself, but my whole family.
It's very courageous of you to talk about it so openly, because it may help others as well. But what took you to that spot, Bossy, do you know?
I just couldn't see a way out, you know. I just thought, you know, I actually thought the place would be, I thought my family would be better off without me. I'd done the carnage that I'd, just the train wreck that I'd been for a little while, and I just thought the place would be better off without me, because it's just going to be a train wreck. But, there was obviously a reason I didn't go. And, you know, when I got back, when I, Liam and that, well, we got myself back, and I went to Scott Perrin's farm in Ngambi, and he's my greatest friend. And geez, I was just taught some real life lessons from him, you know, hard truths. And I needed to hear it. And I thank him bottom of my heart for that. But you can come back, you know, and it was like once I got taught those hard, and I didn't go and see a psychiatrist or anything. I just wanted to, my mates, you know, they're the ones that really, my true friends, they taught me, they told me the things I needed to hear, the real truth. And once I heard that and I realised what a pain in the ass I'd have been in a stupid person, it was like I shed my skin, and I promise you I'd never be like that again. And that was the spring before I come back and won everything.
True.
You know what I mean? I just come back and won everything because I wanted to prove to myself that I could do it.
Did you feel a different person after you'd worked through that darkness?
Oh, my God, yeah. I've had a few moments in my life where I've become a different person, and I've needed reminders. I've needed a big kick up the arse. One was when I broke my neck and come back from that, and this was the biggest one because, as an athlete and a person, you've got high expectations, and when you're not meeting those expectations, you go into a dark spot, and you've got to realise that you can't do this. You can't come back alone. You've got to put your hand up. You've got to ask. You've got to recognise that, yeah, you're going to be scared, and you're going to be vulnerable, but it's okay to be scared, vulnerable. It's okay to put your hand up, and because you can't do it alone. Mm. There's no way you can do it alone. You think you can do it alone? No, you can't, because you just self-medicate and you just try and black it out, but you can't. It's just impossible. So put your hand up and ask for help, and I promise you, when you do that, that's the first step of starting to feeling good again, because you just, and you just become a different person.
Is that an area racing needs to improve on? Obviously, the pressure, which obviously got to you, the 24/7. It's tough on families, especially if you're riding overseas, but just the relentless cycle of work as well. And is there enough support and help? Because a lot of people in racing are probably just like you. They don't want to tell anyone.
Well, life has got very complicated, hasn't it, for young people? You know, there's social media. Everyone's got a voice now, and they can just stand behind. They can be the keyboard warrior and say some horrible things about horrible people, about good people, and get away with it. So life for young people has got very complicated, and it's got a lot faster than what it was when I was young. So young people need a lot more help. And I'm not. And people say, "Oh, kids are softer these days," and all this sort of stuff. That's not the truth. They've just got a lot more to deal with. They're not softer. That's bullshit. They're smarter than what we were, but they've just got so much more to deal with. The world is a scarier place than when G Boss was 16 and 18. I promise you, we didn't have a fear about anything. Now they've got a lot more to worry about. So we have an obligation to help younger people.
Boss, you're an amazing character. The strength and the openness, you'll help others. And I know that's what you want to do in the future as well. Refreshing and courageous, what you were able to open up with there. We'll take a quick break. On the other side, we're going to change gears just a little bit. I'm going to throw a few names at you. There's a few SMSs coming through. Horses, jockeys, trainers. Maybe give us some of the best and the highlights through an amazing career. Welcome back to Racing Pulse. Glenn Boss in the studio. SMSs are flying through. We love you, Bossy. A true man of the people. Not many can pull it off. Appreciate your openness. This one here. Morning, boys. Can you ask Bossy a tough one? Who is the best jockey he's seen other than himself, Ando and Ballarat?
Well, that's a good question. And it's not one I... Because if I leave people out, it's disrespectful. But I was very captured by Shane Dye. As a young kid, he was an incredible tactician. He taught me so much, and whether you didn't like Shane Dye or you loved him, he was one that was. Mick Kinnane was one that I was just absolutely gobsmacked when I watched him ride. He was a poet on a horse.
What about trainer? Who do you think's the best trainer you've ridden for?
Guy Walter.
Really?
Yeah, I love this guy. I wish he was still here. He was a true artist with a horse. Yeah, his patience, his demeanour, the way he did things. I just loved being around this guy. He only worked with a small team, but the team he had, geez, he produced some great horses.
You've achieved so much. Is there a little hole with that Caulfield Cup and what it could have been this spring carnival?
Yeah, obviously, yeah, that was something that I would have loved to achieve, but. Like I said on Saturday, you know what, not winning that race and not winning the Caulfield will not define me as a person or a jockey. It's just something I didn't quite get to, you know, but big deal.
I'll throw a few horses at you. Quick response. Flying Spur.
Superstar.
Juggler.
Great warrior.
Indigos.
Special talent.
Sky Heights.
Oh, Sky, it's just a beast.
Shogun Lodge.
The greatest of greatest warriors I've ever ridden.
Yeah. Show a Heart. The Queenslander.
Yeah, a sexy looking individual. Beautiful horse.
Schwazier. You won the Lightning?
Yeah, he was just all power and strength.
Fastnet Rock.
One of the best horses I've ever ridden.
Starcraft.
Yeah, an exceptional, talented three-year-old.
And then as we move further down through some of your horses at your road, obviously Maccabi Diva dominates them. We've spoken about God's Own. Racing to Win was another good horse.
Yeah, he helped set me on a path of greatness.
Sebring, another slipper.
Yeah, immensely talented horse we've never seen the best of.
Haylist.
Wow. Without, he would have been the champion's champion without Black Caviar being around, wouldn't he?
And then your last major on Sir Dragonette.
Yeah, I wish we'd seen more of him. That was a sad day that he had to be euthanized. And he did it on the paddock, which was he died doing what he loved. He was a very highly talented racehorse, and he was still a foal when I won the slip, when they won the Cox Plate on him. He was still going to mature and be a proper horse.
Vossie, amazing hour and a bit you've allowed us to open up into your mind, your psyche, the emotional side, but the highs as well. And I think the sport is so lucky to have you wanting to remain part of it as an ambassador. I'm looking forward to seeing what you're going to be doing with Ladbrokes. It's going to be some amazing stuff. And then also working with all of the people within the sport to try and help them and help the image of the sport as well.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. And thanks to RSL for just giving me this platform. I mean, I didn't had any conscious thoughts of bringing that out, but you being the person you are, and I respect it, it felt appropriate, you know what I mean? Because I have such a respect for you and your job, and you're a master at this craft, and you just brought it out of me, and I thank you very much for that.
I appreciate you, Bossy. You're going to help a lot of people with what you've said today, and the good news is there's one show left. The Boss Man is coming back to ride for Australia at the Saudi Cup meeting. We'll take a break.